So thank you very much for that kind introduction. When I looked at my placement on the program and saw that I was coming after a discussion of Europe and before a discussion on Latin America, I have to say, as a policymaker, my job seems much easier than the problems of the rest of the world. I appreciate the placement that I was put on today. Despite the fact that our problems may be a little simpler than those that were just described in the previous panel, there's still some interesting challenges that we have, but more often than not, I would say that we're quite fortunate in the United States that we're at a very different point in our economic recovery than most of the rest of the world. And I know you had Esther George here to start out the program, and she talked a little bit about the balance sheet. I think you're going to find some areas where there's a lot of commonality, and then some differences and nuances that I'll talk a little bit about. So in terms of the economy, I did read Esther. I wasn't here for the first day, unfortunately, and this morning was a wonderful set of panels. But last night I did get a chance to read her speech. And I think in terms of the economy, we're pretty much in the same place. So unlike the ECB, we have a dual mandate. So we have to worry about both inflation and unemployment. And the good news is we're pretty close to our dual mandate, that both aspects of our dual mandate are relatively close. So on the unemployment rate side, we have an unemployment rate at 4.5%. By historical standards, that's quite good. It's actually below my estimate of full employment, which is 4.7%. It's at the low end of where my peers on the FOMC think full employment is. So at least by the standard U3 measure of unemployment, we're pretty much where we want to be in terms of labor markets. In terms of inflation, I'd say we're still a little soft relative to our 2% target. Right now, total PCE is actually slightly above 2%, 2.1%. Core PCE is at 1.8%. But we're fluctuating around our 2% target. So in many respects, we're very close on the inflation target as well as the unemployment rate. So that's very good news, and that's one reason why we're in a very different place than Europe or Japan. And that we're now talking about a very positive thing, which is how do we normalize policy that has been extraordinarily accommodative over the last 10 years, and in my view, very appropriately so. And the balance sheet, I think, was actually, it only got a little discussion in that previous panel, but I think the balance sheet has been a very important tool, not only for the Federal Reserve, but for central banks around the world. And so I'm going to focus my remarks on the balance sheet as a tool, and talk a little bit about how we should think about the normalization process. Now, at the outset, I would say there was a very good reason for us to be expanding the balance sheet. And during the financial crisis, I was very, very supportive of expanding the Federal Reserve balance sheet. The reason is very simple. We've got the normal way that we conduct monetary policy is by moving short-term interest rates. We got our federal funds rate basically down to zero, but we still had an unemployment rate that was very high and an inflation rate that was very low. So we weren't achieving the objectives that we had for monetary policy. So we had to look at another tool that would enable us to actually stimulate the recovery and get back to where we're supposed to be. And so that tool was to purchase long-term assets, mostly treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities, with the intention of flattening the yield curve. So even though the short-term interest rates had hit zero, long-term rates had not hit zero, and that gave us the option to do a policy that flattened the yield curve that would stimulate the economy. In my own view, that stimulus was very much needed, and is one of the reasons why we've had the recovery that we've had to date. So we've had a role of an expanded balance sheet. I think one of the focuses of my comments today is that some people are viewing this as possibly a once-in-a-lifetime event, that it was a reaction to the very severe economic outcomes that we had as a result of the financial crisis. And so they're thinking about the balance sheet and normalizing the balance sheet in a framework that's thinking that this is a one-time event. My own view is a little bit different, and it really highlights the fact that there are changes in the macro economy that I think are actually quite critical, some of which Peter brought up in his presentation. We've had much lower productivity, not only in Europe, but in the United States as well. Around the world, we have lower inflation rates. and around the world, population trends. We have aging populations around the world. We have lower birth rates. Many countries we're also seeing less in-migration. Well, that means that the population growth is not nearly as substantial either. So the combination of low inflation and low potential growth because of some of the population and demographic variables means that we're not going to have very much of a buffer when we're thinking about monetary policy. And as a result, I'm expecting that it's not going to be that uncommon that in recessions, we get the federal funds rate, or whatever our target at that time is, down very close to zero, requiring us to think about balance sheet outcomes again. And I think that's going to be true in Japan. I think it's going to be true in Europe, unless either countries pick a higher inflation target or unless countries are able to find a way to get potential GDP to be growing much faster. So in terms of the future use of the balance sheet, Federal Reserve policymakers are asked every quarter about a wide set of economic variables. And I'm not going to talk about the wide set of economic variables, but I am going to talk about where we think the federal funds rate will be in the long run. So that's one of the questions we're asked at every summary of economic projections, where when we're at full complement, we have 12 Reserve Bank presidents and we have 7 governors. And the interest rate that they think we're going to have in the long run for the federal funds rate, which is the short-term rate that we affect for monetary policy, is that it's likely to only be 3%. Well, 3% is not very much room between 0 and 3%, which means that if you have a recession that requires more monetary policy accommodation than 3%, you're going to be back to zero again. In other words, the 300 basis points is probably not much of a cushion, which means in a standard recession, we've normally increased much more than 300 basis points or decreased much more than 300 basis points. And as a result, if we have standard recessions going forward, we're likely to be at the zero lower bound again in the future, which just means that we're going to have to do balance sheet activities again in the future. And so as we think about the balance sheet normalization, we should be thinking about this as a more standard monetary policy tool, not as a once-in-a-lifetime exceptional action. And so you think a little bit differently about it if you're thinking about this as a fairly standard tool of monetary policy going forward. Now, I would argue that there is a big difference between the balance sheet and short-term interest rates. Central banks around the world have a lot of experience moving short-term interest rates in order to meet their objectives, either an inflation target like in Japan or in Europe, or in the Federal Reserve, worrying about both inflation and the unemployment rate. So we have a lot of historical experience, we have a lot of statistical work that's been done, so we have a pretty good idea that if we change the federal funds rate by a certain amount, not with perfect certainty by any means, but with a lot more certainty than other tools, we have an idea of what the impact will be on the economy. The balance sheet, we basically have one observation in the US, Japan, and Europe, and to date, nobody has successfully exited from a very large balance sheet. So it makes sense that our primary tool should be the short-term rate. The secondary tool is the balance sheet that primarily gets taken out at times when we can't use that short-term rate. That has implications for what an exit strategy ought to look like. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that over the course of my time. First, I'm going to argue that any kind of exit strategy should be very gradual. And I would argue it should be pretty soon. That if it's very gradual, it's much less likely to disrupt markets. And what we're really talking about with shrinking the balance sheet is how quickly or how slowly do we reinvest securities that are coming due. So people aren't talking about selling securities. They're talking about as a security comes due, how much of those proceeds do we reinvest? And we can do that at either a gradual rate or we could do it at a very quick rate. I'm arguing it should be gradual enough that it doesn't have sizable effects on financial markets and the economy, and that we should be using the short-term interest rate as the main tool to try to achieve our targets related to inflation and unemployment. So the shrinkage of the balance sheet should primarily be in the background, not as a fine-tuning tool, but as a tool that we do take out when we have recessions and when we can't use our short-term tool. So I'm going to take you through a whole bunch of graphs. I don't speak as much in words. I know Esther had a speech. I kind of speak through graphs. So I'm going to talk a little bit about graphs, some of which are going to hit some of the highlights. Peter had a similar chart in his packet. This first chart done a little differently than the one that he had. So it's looking, there are three different lines here. So the United States, this is the short-term interest rate. So in the United States, it's the federal funds rate. You know, that's in dark, I guess, purple. The euro area is in orange, and Japan is in green. Now, the first thing to notice is that you don't want to be Japan. They've had interest rates that were stuck at zero, and they've been stuck basically at zero for a very long time. In my view, that's the consequence of not acting aggressively when you have a really bad shock to your economy. And if you don't act aggressively, the result is that you stay at the zero lower bound much longer than anybody wants to. So there is a cost to deciding not to aggressively tackle a problem, and I think that problem is actually shown by what you're seeing in Japan. Now you can see the European and US lines are a little bit different. We have the ability to move our short-term rates until the financial crisis, and we didn't hit the zero lower bound at the previous recession, so we didn't have to use a balance sheet. But as you get to the financial crisis, you can see that we dropped our interest rates very quickly down to zero, much faster than what occurred in Europe. And our economies recovered more quickly, and I would argue it's kind of it's a combination of a lot of things, but it's in part a combination of a very aggressive monetary policy taken early on and the fact that we had the ability to address some of our banking problems a little bit more expeditiously than other places in the world. And you can see that we've started the normalization process. Now, it's a very gradual normalization process. We increased the federal funds rate in December 2015 and December 2016, and then most recently last month in March. So we've tightened three times, 75 basis points, and this is the part we started our normalization process. So of the three, we're the first one to be able to move the short-term interest rates. And the idea was that we'd move short-term interest rates first so that if we did have a negative shock, we'd have the ability to work with the tool that we had the most confidence in so we could bring it back down if we had to, and hopefully we don't have to. So we have had those three tightenings. So a logical question is, what do you do with the balance sheet? So this shows the balance sheet in the same three. And you can see what I've done is I've standardized it relative to January of 2000. So the way to think of this is, what was the path of these three balance sheets from 2000 over time? So the first thing to notice is, that people didn't talk about balance sheets from 2000 to 2007. It wasn't an interesting thing to talk about. But the balance sheets increased very gradually. They basically increased as currency and circulation was increasing. And nobody was really talking about balance sheets as being a significant tool for monetary policy. In the fall of 2007, when the financial crisis really started to be a problem in the United States, the first thing we had to do is address the very significant liquidity problems in financial markets. That included money market funds, that included the commercial paper market. So as a result of what was going on in short-term markets, we substantially increased our balance sheet very, very quickly to reflect the liquidity problems that we were having in the market. Over time, those liquidity problems were changed into an asset purchase program. And you can see that we were expanding our balance sheet quite significantly through this period, buying both long-term treasury securities and buying mortgage-backed securities for exactly the mechanism I was talking about before. We're trying to flatten the yield curve. We were constrained. We couldn't do anything at the short end of the market. We had to do something at the long end of the market, and that's exactly what we did. So the result was, instead of just dealing with reserves, which you normally do with the federal funds market, you're purchasing assets, and you can see that we've got a very different solution historically in terms of what our balance sheet looked like. Now, I would highlight that in the United States, it was very aggressive at first, but we've also got to the point where while we started to hold our securities constant. So as those securities came due, if 5 years ago we bought a 5-year Treasury security, and it comes due today, we've just been reinvesting those proceeds. So that's had the impact of, that's why we have a flat line in the United States for bank assets, that we've been just buying back Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities to keep our portfolio constant. Now, because the balance sheet normally grows, it actually means that excess reserves are going down a little bit. So in some sense, as soon as we stopped growing our balance sheet, that was a tightening. So we have been, in some sense, tightening up on the balance sheet ever since we decided not to have it grow over time. Now you can see that Japan and Europe didn't grow nearly as quickly initially, but they're still having to expand their balance sheet because they're not getting the economic outcomes they want. They're still not hitting their inflation targets. And as a result, I would argue that by being very aggressive early on, it has meant that we've been able to stop a little bit sooner. This is a little clearer this is the chart that Peter had relative to GDP. I took it back to 2000, so this just highlights relative to GDP, our balance sheets were a little bit different in 2000. But then if you look at it over time, yes, we expanded the balance sheet very quickly in the United States, but relative to the size of the economy, it seems a lot more manageable than what you've had in other central banks around the world. Particularly notable is what happened in Japan, where relative to GDP, they've really expanded their balance sheet in order to try to get their economy moving again. Peter also mentioned the yield curve differences, and so this is actually showing that as well. So if you look at the blue, which is the United States, or I guess it's purple, whatever you want to call this, we've been fluctuating roughly 2.25, 2.5. It's a little soft recently. Since that time where we started to raise short-term rates and stabilize our balance sheet, the 10-year Treasury rate has been trading around a little bit above 2%. I showed you the chart that Japan and Europe have been continuing to do these asset purchases, and not surprisingly, you're seeing that the 10-year rate is going down. We know that the short-term rates are at zero. So it's a very different yield curve between the United States and those of Japan and various European countries. So that's where we've been. Let's talk a little bit more about why I think we're going to be back in this place fairly frequently, or at least around any significant economic downturn. So this is the summary of economic projections that I was talking about at the introduction to my remarks. So it's the 19 people that participate in monetary policy, the 12 Reserve Bank presidents and the 7 governors when we have all 7, which we haven't had for several years, but when we do have 7 governors. The dark blue in this chart is the median. So you can see the median back in January 2012 was 4.25%. You can see the median right now is 3%. So the median has come down. The shaded area reflects the central tendency. The central tendency throws out the 3 highest observations and the 3 lowest observations, but just gives you an idea of how certain or uncertain people are in terms of how big a spread is there between the people that are being asked in the survey to come up with what they think the federal funds rate will be in the long run. So you can see that it was pretty uncertain in 2012. It's a little bit tighter now, but with the median at 3, there are an awful lot of people that actually think it could be lower than 3%. Well, that's actually a fairly substantial change in a relatively short period of time in where people think the interest rate's going to be in the long run. So if you're only at 3% or a little bit lower, and you have a bad economic shock, you only have 300 basis points to move short-term rates before you're back to zero again. So there is a consequence to having a federal funds rate that is at a much lower rate. And I'm going to illustrate that with a couple of charts. So this chart shows you the federal funds rate over time. And you can see that they're red dots. So for each of the periods between recessions, I've looked at the low point and the high point. And other than this first period where there was a relatively modest decline, you can see that many of the declines are actually quite substantial. You can see how little the recent increase seems relative to how much we've come down during recessions, the shadings reflecting recessions. So not surprisingly, during recessions, the Federal Reserve reacts by easing interest rates, it comes down. But you can see that if you only have 300 basis points, gee, you'd be hitting zero very, very frequently if it was the similar way that we would react. And in fact, this next chart just does the adding up for you. So it's looking at each of those peak periods, which are shown in chronological order in this first column. The second column shows you how much we caused the federal funds rate to decline from peak to trough in each of those recessions. And I would highlight where the high rate was here. So you can see in this column, you're seeing numbers like 6, 8%. So those are big declines in nominal interest rates at the short end of the market in order to try to get the economy to recover. And the reason we could do that is we had much higher interest rates to start from. So even though we were at much higher rates, you can see in the low column that the only time we actually hit zero was this last recession, which was both very severe, but we also didn't start at nearly as high a point as we have previously. So if you put in context a federal funds rate of 300 basis points, and think about how we've responded in previous recessions using monetary policy, it has an implication for how frequently you're going to expect to be back in the situation we're in. The second chart does the same thing, but does a simple calculation to give you the real federal funds rate rather than the nominal federal funds rate. So all I've done is deflated by core PCE. So in round numbers, think that we have 2% inflation right now. We have a federal funds rate a little less than 1, but let's call it 1. So the real federal funds rate right now is 1 minus 2, negative 1. So you can see on this chart that we're roughly at negative 1% right here. So it's just showing you what the real federal funds rate is. Now the reason I show it in real terms rather than just in nominal terms is that it highlights that it's not that uncommon to actually lower the federal funds rate enough that it's lower than the inflation rate, which means after inflation, you're getting a negative return. In fact, it's pretty common in previous recessions to actually get negative real interest rates. You can see in the 1970s, we were able to get quite negative. Now, one reason you can get so negative, one, you know the interest rate didn't get down to zero from the previous chart, but it got down to negative 4, well, that reflects a much higher inflation rate at that time. The variation that you're seeing here, so you know from 2008, we were basically at zero. So this is basically showing you variation in core PCE. So if you have the federal funds rate bounded at zero, you have an inflation rate only about 2%, you're only going to get negative 2% in real rate when you hit a recession. But you can see it's not that uncommon to have negative real rates. And again, this shows you the same chart in real terms. And so I would emphasize the lows here. So you can see it wasn't uncommon to get negative real rates in response to a recession. It is a little less common to have negative rates stay negative for as long as they have. So normally in a normal recovery, we wouldn't hit the zero lower bound, and relatively quickly we get off the negative real rates. But we weren't able to bring rates low enough to get that faster recovery, because we only had an inflation rate that was less than 2%, so they couldn't get that negative. That's why we ended up having to use our balance sheet to try to actually affect the long end of the market as well. So you can see that it's quite likely, even in the past, that we would get negative real interest rates, but it was not so likely that you'd hit the zero lower bound. So there are some implications from this. We have a limited buffer, so if we're only going to be at 300 basis points in the long run, it means we don't have a very big buffer before we hit the zero lower bound. In terms of real rates, you might expect us to get there more frequently. And you might expect, particularly if we're slow to do balance sheet or other activities, that we might stay there for a little bit longer. In terms of the nominal federal funds rate, we're likely to hit zero much more frequently. So the implication of that is it's going to have to be more common for central banks in the course of a recession, as long as we're right that the short-term federal funds rate is going to stay low, that we're going to have to use asset purchases to stimulate the economy. So as we're thinking about our exit strategy right now, we shouldn't be thinking about this as a one-time event. We should be thinking about this as a common practice unless we change the inflation target or we're able to do something about the population and labor force growth or something about productivity. If all those remain low, then we end up in a situation that I've just described. So let me just cover those three elements briefly to highlight why my expectation is, at least in the near term, those conditions aren't likely to change too dramatically. So you can see the inflation process in the United States has actually changed pretty dramatically. So during the period of oil shortages, we had very substantial increases in the inflation rate. One reason we were able to get so negative during this period was because we started from such high inflation rates, which meant we could bring the nominal rate down very substantially, and we could actually get a very low real interest rate. You can see since roughly the mid-80s that the Federal Reserve and many other central banks have been much more focused on hitting a 2% or around a 2% inflation target. And you can see, while we didn't have it explicit, we had it implicitly, and more recently it is explicit. And you can see since the mid-90s, we have been fluctuating around that 2%. It has been relatively stable, particularly when you think about the severity of the economic shocks that we've seen more recently. So one reason why we're going to hit the zero lower bound more frequently is that we have an inflation rate that's much lower. Now, there are clearly some good things about low inflation, so I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It is a good thing, but we have to realize that a low inflation rate has an implication for how often we're going to use the balance sheet. If you pick a low inflation target, you're also picking less of a buffer, which means you're going to hit the zero lower bound more frequently, so you got to get more comfortable using the balance sheet, because that'll be the only other way that monetary policy is going to be able to stimulate the economy. Turning to productivity growth, now this is a heavily smoothed series. If I showed you output per hour without smoothing it, it would look like a seismic graph. It's all over the place. So what I've done is I've smoothed this over 40 quarters, 10 years, to give you an idea, because productivity is really something that's more of a long-run phenomenon. Now, this is not something that economists think monetary policy can have much of an impact on. It can really matter what's happening in education. Lots of things can affect productivity in terms of possibly tax policy and other fiscal measures, but it's not something monetary policy can do anything about. So it's basically a given for monetary policy. You can see that there have been periods where productivity has been low in the United States. There have been periods where productivity has been very high. But more recently, the productivity in the United States has been quite low. Again, that's an attribute that you see not only in the United States, but many other countries. So if you have very low productivity, that's not an environment where you're going to expect an equilibrium interest rate that's particularly high. You're not going to have nearly as much investment in a world where we have very low productivity. Similarly, the labor force has changed pretty dramatically. Again, it's a little bit noisy, but in the 60s going up to the 70s, we had some fairly rapid increases in population that reflected higher birth rates, that reflected reasonably high immigration patterns. and it reflected women coming from outside the labor force into the labor force. So we had some significant increases in the labor force initially, but all three of those trends are reversing themselves. The birth rate has come down. We're unlikely to have very substantial immigration over the next couple of years, I think we can safely say. And there's no reason to expect that we're going to have a huge inflow of women. The participation rate's already quite high in the economy. So the result is that the labor force trend, that green line, looks like it's going to be flatter. So again, if you have a slower population growth, if the demographics are slowing you down, then you're not going to need to have as high an equilibrium interest rate. So when you put those three graphs together, we have a lower inflation rate, we have lower productivity, and we have a population that's not going to be growing, a labor force that's not going to be growing particularly fast. So one, there's going to be a trade-off between that inflation target and how often you're willing to manipulate the balance sheet. Choosing a low inflation target is also choosing that more than likely you're going to be hitting negative real rates and zero nominal rates more frequently. It's not unique to the United States. I don't want to speak for Peter, but my guess is the same thing holds in Europe, and the same thing is likely to hold in Japan. So it's actually a global phenomenon. It's going to be a general issue for central banks. And so balance sheet tools are going to be a necessary feature of recessions unless one of those three variables changes. So in conclusion, I see it quite likely that central banks in the future are going to have to use balance sheet. So it means it's important for us to try to get this right, not only for the economy right now, but this is actually a playbook for the future too. We can't assume that this is a one-time event. In my own view, now that we're very close to both our inflation and employment target, it is appropriate to be shrinking our balance sheet. I would argue the sooner the better, that we should start shrinking the balance sheet now that the federal funds rate is off the zero bound. But we should do it gradually enough that we don't disrupt financial markets. So initially that means that we still repurchase a lot of those securities. We only allow a little of them to run off at first, but that grows over time. In effect, I'm arguing that the balance sheet should be something that's occurring in the background, but doesn't have much of an impact in terms of whether we think the federal funds rate should go up or down. We would use the federal funds rate, the variable that we know a lot more about in terms of we have a long historical experience with it. We'll use that to adjust the economy. Hopefully we have a very nice long recovery. We get a normalized balance sheet. We get interest rates to a more normal level. But if, whenever we do get that negative shock, we shouldn't be shocked if 300 basis points isn't enough, and we actually have to then use the balance sheet again. So that concludes my remarks. I'd be glad to take some questions.
Presentation. When I put it that way, I'm proud of you. I'm an Ulster, the Federal Reserve family. But you really didn't answer to one question, which is why shrink the balance sheet at all? So I would like to hear what you have to say on that. And the other question is, can you imagine circumstances in which you actually would want to sell because you want to actually raise the yield curve. In some sense, in the conundrum period, one might have thought that it would have been useful to be able to put upward pressure on long-term interest rates in that period.
Yeah, you can make an argument for using a balance sheet in a more aggressive manner. The risk with that is, I think we have so little experience with it, that say you were in a situation for financial stability reasons, that you wanted to raise the long end of the curve, and you chose to do it by signaling that you were going to sell assets. You don't know how much you're going to sell. The market doesn't know how much you're going to sell. I don't know how much the market's going to react to that. And the market could very easily steepen the yield curve much more than I'm anticipating. So some of the logic in this talk is that because there's so much uncertainty about the balance sheet, that I'd much rather be manipulating things with the federal funds rate and leaving the balance sheet more in background. It's something we're going to need during recessions, but during recoveries, it's not something that I would necessarily want to use as an active tool. Now, there may be circumstances where inflation's taking off, financial stability, you're worried about asset prices taking off, and the Fed may make a different calculation at that time. That's not the situation we're in right now. So I think in the current circumstances, it's completely appropriate. In terms of shrinking the balance sheet, I think that there are some advantages to operating closer to a more normalized balance sheet. Some of those are political, but clearly it's been quite unpopular to have as large a balance sheet as we've had. You do worry about spillovers to other countries as well. And arguably, we don't need to force the long end to be unusually low. There's no reason why we shouldn't have a more normalized yield curve when we're basically at our unemployment mandate and we're basically at our inflation mandate. So ideally, we don't have to manipulate the yield curve. And I think as we get to where we were supposed to be, that it is appropriate that we exit to the extent that we're able to from the balance sheet that we have. So that would be the reason why I would actually start the roll-off now. And since I think that a roll-off is necessary, starting sooner allows me to be quite fragile. But it will have the effect of slowly increasing the yield curve, but it will be slow enough that it shouldn't affect my ability to use the short-term rate to be the main way that I am hitting my inflation and unemployment rate goals.
You got a follow-up, Marsh?
You can go ahead.
Okay, go ahead.
So you mentioned how the U.S. and the Federal Reserve has a fairly low inflation target, being 2%, and that other countries, or it may be an option for other countries to increase their inflation target in order to seem more accommodative with their real rate. Do you think that any time in the future the Fed would use this as another unconventional tool in order to become more accommodative, or do you think that it would have larger negative impacts on the credibility of the Fed?
So right now, in the Federal Reserve and other central banks, the target is 2%. There are some academics that have argued it should be other than 2%. I'm just highlighting that there's a trade-off between picking a 2% inflation target and whether you're likely to hit the zero lower bound. So if you told me that under no circumstances do I want you to do an asset purchase in the future, then I probably shouldn't pick 2%, because otherwise it means I'm turning off monetary policy pretty frequently, and then I have to rely on fiscal policy. Between a higher balance sheet or relying on fiscal policy, my personal preference would be a higher balance sheet. So I think that we have to think about that trade-off. I think countries should, so the Bank of Canada does consider their inflation target every 5 years and ask whether it's appropriate. These are one of the things that we should be discussing on a regular basis, is how comfortable are we manipulating the balance sheet? The less comfortable we are, then you have to start saying, what are the pros and cons of having a higher inflation rate? It's a much bigger talk to talk about the pros and cons of changing the inflation target, but I think it's something that should be actively debated.
I'll go. One, two, three.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you the same question as I was going to ask Peter from ECB. I was going to ask him about quantitative easing and about, so yeah, expanding the balance sheets, and when if that means buying a large amount of assets in the markets, what does that really mean? What are the risks of making asset bubbles? Mm-hmm. Or what does it really, can you say a little bit about what does it really mean? How does it really affect the market when a big actor goes in and buys that huge amounts of assets in the market like that? What are the implications?
So one of the implications and one of the concerns is exactly the one that you highlighted, the potential financial stability. So you are, when you buy assets, if it's an interest-bearing asset, you're pushing the interest rate down lower than it would be in the absence of your purchases. And that's exactly what your policy is intended to do. So our intention was to make it easier to buy cars and houses. So in order to do that, you have to lower the interest rates. Now, it is possible to buy too many cars and houses. It is possible to have too much commercial real estate. That is the potential downside of using balance sheet much more aggressively. So I think asset bubbles and financial stability concerns This is a fairly untried tool. It's a tool that we've used during this crisis. It wasn't just the U.S., it was Europe and it was Japan. But I think that we have to see, and part of that is, how effective are we at getting back to a normal balance sheet over time? So some of that concern would be, when is it appropriate to start exiting that balance sheet? And are you able to exit early enough that you don't allow some of those bubbles to become a serious problem? If you start waiting too long, and you're keeping rates artificially low for assets that, finance houses or finance commercial real estate, then you do potentially have a problem. So that's why the exit strategy is just as important as the entry. So the entry was critically important. It was critically important because otherwise we turned off monetary policy once the short-term rate hit zero. I don't think that's good policy. But the true success is that we're able to get out of that policy as well, which is why I'd rather start relatively soon, but do it gradually enough that I don't think it's a big problem.
There's one quick question. What is this, the connection, how strong is the connection between the expansion of the balance sheet and the exchange rate? I mean, that leads to a higher devaluation and then try to export more, enhance the exportation. Do you have something to say about that?
So both short-term rates and long-term rates are connected to the exchange rate in meaningful ways. So I think that is a good question. That is something that we think about. We do have an exchange rate. When we're doing an economic forecast, we're not only thinking about what we're doing in terms of the short-term rate and quantitative easing, we are thinking about what we expect the effect to be on the exchange rate. And certainly one of the mechanisms that quantitative easing works is not just that we lower the rate, which encourages you to buy houses and cars, it's also it has an impact on the exchange rate. So actually right now, Japan and Europe are benefiting from the fact that we're raising rates earlier, and potentially both short and long-term rates, so that they don't have to have quite a stimulative a policy, because we're exporting less, but they're exporting more. So to the extent that we're exiting a little bit earlier, it actually is advantageous for our trading partners. That's the exchange rate mechanism working in their favor in this case. So it does. You can't look at interest rates without thinking about exchange rates as well, so it does have an impact. Behind you, there are two questions.
Couple things.
You only get one. You have a couple others.
There's a stress on about the need for a cushion, but how do we know that a quarter point cut these days with low inflation, low trend growth, would have more of an outsized impact than it would have prior to the crisis, and therefore we won't need this cushion of 300 or 400 basis points? And then just quickly,
let me answer that question, and we're going to pass the mic just because there are a bunch of other people. But we actually know that lowering the short-term rates in this last recession wasn't enough. We hit zero, the unemployment rate was high, and the inflation rate was low. So in order to get to our objective, we had to do something differently, or you had to be willing to do Japan and just sit there for a long period of time. So Japan's an example of what happens when you decide to let interest rates get to zero and you sit there. You can sit there for a long time. They've sat there for more than two decades. I think that it's much more sensible to think about how do you aggressively achieve your targets. So I think the fact that we were aggressive on the balance sheet, that we were aggressive on short-term rates, is one reason why we're talking about exiting both the short-term rates and the balance sheet now.
Herman Minsky used to talk about reconstituted finance in the financial system in the U.S. in order to foster the capital development economy. And among the government and also the Federal Reserve functions of supervising the financial system and reconstituting that, what do you think about this Minsky's proposal?
So bank supervision is probably not the topic of my talk. It was more the topic of Tom Honig's talk. But I actually think that you can't conduct good monetary policy without good supervisory and regulatory policy as well. And so certainly one of the reasons that we hit the zero lower bound, it wasn't just a random shock, it was a shock that decimated our financial system. So if we had been in a situation where our financial system was much more resilient, then we would not have needed to do the extraordinary measures that we actually did. So to the earlier question, this was partly a reflection of how severe the financial crisis was. But I'd go back to my federal funds chart that shows how frequently we decrease interest rates by far more than 300 basis points. Basically, other than the very first one in the early 1960s, every single recession we've lowered rates by more than 300 basis points. So we do have to think about supervisory policy. I was a bank supervisor as well as a macroeconomist. I think they're integrally related. It's why I think it's so important that central banks actually have responsibilities for bank supervision. So I do think we have to think about both what's happening to our banking system, but also the shadow banking system. And those are very important to thinking about how our monetary policy should be conducted. And to the earlier question, it gets to the financial stability issues. So I think those are very important issues to be considering. Those are separate from the macroeconomic tools of thinking about the balance sheet and thinking about the federal funds rate. So why don't I take two more questions, and then I'll stop. I'll take one here and then one there. And I think there's a, what happened to the mic?
Okay.
That's all right.
Tom, thank you. Tom has said that he wants a low internal rate in order to avoid the overvaluation of the dollar, in order to avoid to lose competitiveness. How the Fed is going to manage the inflation target with the wishes of the government in order to increase competitiveness?
So the inflation target is something that has been picked by our central bank and other central banks prior to the prior to the most recent period, certainly prior to this election. So we're setting an inflation target where we think it's not going to have a big effect on economic decisions overall. So there are some benefits to having a low inflation rate, and certainly having a stable inflation rate, there are a lot of benefits too. So in that chart, not only were we closer to 2%, but the volatility around 2% was less. So I think the big benefits to having a low, stable inflation rate. The only point I'm trying to make in this talk is that there are trade-offs with, if you don't have much of a buffer, there are some good aspects to a low inflation rate, but there's a consequence when you have a recession and have to use balance sheet. So that's the trade-off that I was focusing in this talk. So one last question.
Thank you. Your first chart, which kind of showed the Europe, US, Japan, and Japan was sort of stuck here with little blips and then continues, and you said that's the biggest fear, the problem, you don't want to be there. But to me, and all the charts you showed afterwards and the discussion we're having, it looks like we might be in what Japan was 30 years ago, because it's taken us about 9 years to start slowly moving up. And if we have a recession, say next year, we might come down immediately. So we might look like Japan, because they had a little blip too. They tried to go up and they came down again, so they really couldn't go up. So we might be 30 years later looking at the same chart, and we might be very much Japan. You're not worried about that?
I worry about everything. But I would say that if you look at most economic forecasts right now, they expect that the growth rate's going to be a little north of 2% over the course of this year. So GDP for the first quarter looks like it's going to be half of what we were expecting. But most people are expecting a bounce back in the second quarter, reflecting more consumption, and then the third and fourth quarter being a little bit above 2%. If you think potential in the United States is 1.75%, that's actually enough to continue to tighten labor markets and put upward pressure on inflation. So why are we pulling back on accommodation, both with our balance sheet and with short-term rates? It's because we're reasonably confident that we're at a place where there's a sustainable recovery. Now, that isn't to say that we couldn't have a shock, as the whole panel right before me was talking about one of the possible shocks. That you could have something happen in Europe, that could be a problem. You could have something happen in the South China Sea, that could be a problem. There are a lot of geopolitical issues that clearly could be a problem for the U.S. economy. So we can't prevent negative shocks from buffeting our economy. We can't expect, though, that negative shocks are necessarily going to occur. If they're really high probability, then we should be factoring that in. But most forecasters are actually expecting we're going to continue to have the unemployment rate drift down. A lot of the economic forecasts are actually for the unemployment rate to drift down to the low fours. That's much lower than historically we've had without getting some inflation pressures. So I think there is the risk that you highlight, which is that we have a bad negative shock and then we're back to the zero lower bound. There's also the shock of waiting too long in allowing the economy to get away from us. So we have to balance both of those, and that balancing act changes over time depending on what's happening in the world and in financial markets. I think we have the balance about right. I actually think that it is appropriate to continue to be raising the short-term federal funds rate, that I think that the economy is strong enough to sustain that right now, even though I'd say that the recent data has been a little softer than I was expecting. But I'm expecting it to pick up and that to continue over the course of this year. Same thing with the balance sheet. You don't exit your balance sheet if you think that you're about to go into recession, but that's not my expectation. My expectation is the U.S. economy will continue to recover. I have no idea what fiscal policy will be, but I don't think people are expecting that it will be contractionary. They're expecting it will be expansionary. If that's true, that provides further stimulus to the economy. So I'll end there, and I'll answer questions over lunch, but thank you very much.